don't be nervous about me taking off my jacket. I adhere to the AME doctrine of public speaking. That's the AME church where I grew up, which is be good, be quick, and then be gone. I want to first say thank you to one of my sheroes, Joy Hoffman. Joy, I only disagree with you on one thing. It would have been almost impossible for you to be with me 13 years ago, seeing as that would have made you about 12. Joy Hoffman and the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, the team, Craig, thank you very much. Jack, who was with me prior to the Federal Reserve, as we worked together with the Bankers Bus Tour in 1994 in Oakland, California, to bring attention to Oakland. I'm proud to say that just last month, when people told us to get out of Oakland, that we weren't locals, that we didn't understand Oakland. They told us that we could never do anything in Oakland. We would do no good, told us to leave. Want to make God laugh, tell him your plan. I'm proud to say that last month we opened a $2 million Hope Center in Oakland, California, with 50 community partners from Oakland, California, in full support of the city. And when it opened, it was front page news in the Oakland Tribune, about as local as you can get. There is no vision, the people perish. I want to also say hello to my friend Lisa from the FDIC. Please raise your hand. Lisa, thanks for being here with us. Dennis Tanimoto, the Hawaii Credit Union League. We have a partnership with the NCUA. I know there's someone else here from the NCUA, as I believe there is, James Jones. And, of course, Commissioner Griffin, who had to leave but wanted to make his presence known so that we all knew how important he feels this issue. And last but not least, I want to acknowledge my sweetie, the love of my life, my shero, my number one shero, my sweetie, my wife. Raise your hand, Sheila Kennedy Bryant. She has no problem traveling to places like Hawaii. I asked her to go to Idaho or to Kansas, or she said, John, you go do that trip. Bring me back pictures. But she's more than welcome to help coming to Hawaii. On a serious note, I want to acknowledge one last friend, a personal friend and a professional colleague and someone who's been extraordinarily helpful to my mission nationally and told me to send you a message here today. His name is Don Weinberg, and he is part of the Weinberg Foundation. The Weinberg Foundation has granted Operation Hope about $1 million over the last 3 years for our work. We have an office in Baltimore where they are based on the mainland, and they support our work nationally. And he told me to tell you that the Weinberg Foundation thinks this is a fabulous an important initiative. And if we decide to go forward, let me rephrase that, if you decide to go forward, because I'm not here to convince you of anything, to sell you anything, to entice you, but to share my vision. But if you decide that you want to go forward, he wants you to know that he would be fully supportive of the initiative and would support our allocating some of our unrestricted funds that they grant to us, to you here in Hawaii. I want to talk very quickly about history, business, public policy, and then what I call movement work. I know that Hawaii is different. Around the 3rd or the 4th century, Polynesians came here. Before that, for countless years, Hawaii was just part of the what I call God's landscape. Not inhibited, not very evolved, in fact, came up literally from the ocean floor. 500 years after the Polynesians, as I understand it, the Tahitians and other islanders came to Hawaii. Then, of course, you had the monarchy in the early 1800s, and that monarchy continued to 1893. The Queen, in 1893, was, you might want to say it, overthrown, to use modern lingo, enticed by an American businessman. This is going to have relevance here in a moment. Fast forward. A U.S. territory in 1900. A state, the 50th state, in 1959, actually August 1959. Local in every way, different from the mainland in every way. The two major turning points have been at the hands of Americans. Not necessarily a positive legacy, I might add. The first time with the Queen, as I've already mentioned, the second time with the territory and then the state, and the way in which, I think that everyone would agree that today Hawaii is a very prosperous place, the way it came about is not exactly fair and equitable. Some people are still trying to recover from that period. My people understand something about an uneven playing field. Fast forward. Let's talk about cultures that collide. You say that Hawaii and the mainland are different. People told me Oakland was different. I've been told that Europe is different. I went to Europe in 1989, and then again in 1998, and I gave the same speech that you were going to have problems in Europe, problems in France, the same problems we're having in the U.S. That you didn't have inner cities, because the inner cities were places like Paris, but you had your poor people in the suburbs. And you're going to have race issues and class issues. And what do you have now in Europe? Race issues and class issues. Different but the same. Cultures that collide. About a century ago, Hawaii had 200,000 people. Eight major islands. How many people do you have today? Let me help you. 1.2 million and change. 1 million people have come to this island. A net gain of 1 million people in a century. Now, as best I can tell, land is finite. You can't grow any more land. In fact, some would argue you might be losing a little. Back to the point. Today, there are no ethnic minorities. Sorry, no ethnic majorities in Hawaii. In fact, a third of all Hawaiians are of mixed race. Sounds to me very much like the mainland. Now let me make the connection. The largest economy in the entire world is the United States of America. The only nation in the entire world where every race of people is within its borders is the United States of America. Nice coincidence. The two leading economies in the United States of America are California and New York. The two most ethnically diverse places in the United States of America, California and New York. Now, I know the joke. There was an earthquake, the world tilted to one side, all the nuts rolled to California, but California is the fifth largest economy in the entire world. Guess where the 10th largest economy in the entire world is? Los Angeles County. I didn't say the 10th largest economy in the United States, or the Western Hemisphere, or North America. The 10th largest economy in the entire world is Los Angeles County. 179 different ethnic groups. The largest population of Koreans outside of Korea, more than 500,000. More Chinese Americans in Southern California than any place in the country. I can go on and on and on. You don't do business with government, you don't do business with companies, you do business with people. And you cannot do business with people you don't reflect, respect, or understand. So the first point I want to make is diversity is not a goody-two-shoes issue. Diversity is a business issue. But that can cut both ways. It is cut against Los Angeles as well. Do you know that there's on average an 18% literacy rate in the state of California? That sounded like a third world country, didn't it? There's an 18% literacy rate in schools in the state of California. Wait a minute, it gets worse. There is a school in South Central Los Angeles with a 1% literacy rate. Do you know how bad that school has to be? You have a 1% literacy rate. I have a better chance of taking my child and putting them in front of PBS and watching television all day and getting educated and putting them in the school. What's the relevance? How do cultures collide? If the 20th century was about race and the color line all over the world, from Japan, he would say, there is no racist issue in Japan. Not true. I've been there 9 times. Speaking of Japanese, to get myself in trouble. English onigashimasu is my best phrase. Sumimasen, but my bad Japanese is my second best phrase. There are dark Japanese. There are farmers. They're out in the prefectures. There are light Japanese. Most of them run Japan. There is the mestizo in Mexico, who's running across the border to get to the United States of America. And then there's the Spaniard, who doesn't want to leave Mexico because he's doing just fine. You've got the caste system in India. You had apartheid in South Africa. We can go on and on and on. My wife's family is a living legacy because her family integrated Australia in 1973. Maybe you didn't hear that. My wife's family integrated Australia in 1973. Check the history books. In 1972, there was a law in Australia prohibiting non-whites from living in Australia. Aborigines didn't even count. The Prime Minister invited my wife's father, the Professor James Kennedy, to come there with his family and be an ambassador for culture for Black America in Australia. And with that, they brought in the Jackson family, and they brought in comedian Bill Cosby and others. By the way, isn't America a great place? The only place where a poor Black kid can grow up to be a rich white man, Michael Jackson. Isn't it great? Isn't this fantastic? Okay, I'm just kidding. A little humor. Just a funny, just a joke. If the 20th century is about race and the color line all over the world, or what we call civil rights, then I'm going to argue that the 21st century is going to be about issues of class and poverty, what I call silver rights. If the 20th century, the first civil right of the 20th century was the right to vote. Witness South Africa, witness the southern states in America. Then I would argue that the first silver right of the 21st century is going to be financial literacy. Let me take it a little further. You may say, John, this doesn't apply to a white. This is not relevant for us. This is not a crisis. It's not an important issue. It's a nice goody-two-shoes issue. Let me see if I can frame this a little better. A friend of mine who's a banker said we have a barbaric economy, where the rich seem to get richer, the poor seem to get poorer, and it is harder today to be middle class. If you were middle class during your parents' era, middle class in America was one parent working, the equivalent of a blue-collar job, back, not brain. A high school education was fine. The other parent stayed home as a domestic engineer and raised your children. Today, middle class is two parents working, brain, not that, and now popular culture is raising your children and you are not making any more money. Can I get an amen? Amen. Let me see if I can get a little closer, because that amen was kind of, that really wasn't heartfelt. See if we can get an honorary Black church going on here. If you're living in California, New York, or Hawaii, and you're making less than $50,000 a year, you are struggling just to make ends meet. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
Okay. So it doesn't matter whether you're Black, white, red, brown, or yellow, it's about green. According to the Wall Street Journal, March of 2004, 70% of all Americans were living from paycheck to paycheck. They didn't say 70% of all black people or 70% of all brown people. 70% of all Americans were living from paycheck to paycheck, one paycheck away from poverty. And in 2001, CNN said 50% of all Americans were living from paycheck to paycheck. Notice the statistics are not going in the right direction. Let me go one step further. The number one cause of a divorce in America today is money. More people filed for bankruptcy in 2002 than graduated from college. Am I getting close enough yet? Let me get a little closer. You all know the Jumpstart Coalition study, which showed a devastating illiteracy rate on financial literacy issues of children. Only 59% had any comprehension at all of financial literacy matters. 289,000 bankruptcy filers in 1989, non-business bankruptcy filers in the U.S., including Hawaii. By the year 2002, it was 1.3 million non-business bankruptcy filers. A huge jump. But the fastest growing group of bankruptcy filers were youth between 18 and 24. Now, think about this. If you want to be class-driven, those weren't black kids or Hispanic kids or low-wealth kids. 18 to 24 are college students getting a master's degree in psychology, an undergraduate degree in bankruptcy, paying for their pizza with a credit card, believe a check is a form of credit, and are calling home to you for more money. A third of all college students graduate college with no idea how they'll make their first payment on their student loan. The average junior in college has $3,000 of consumer debt. The average senior in college has $7,000 of consumer debt and no job. Combined debt on average of a graduating senior is $20,000 and no job. It's not uncommon for somebody to go into the workforce and 15 years later still has not paid off their student loan. Not to mention the credit card they got when they were in college, granted up to $3,000 because they thought it was free money, pay $25 a month on it, and 15 years later are still paying. Am I putting you to sleep? I've got low self-esteem, so I need to know you're with me. Am I bringing you along with me here? Let me see if I can frame this a little tighter. This is an economic era. Every economy goes through four modules: the agricultural age, the industrial age, the technology age, and the information age. Where's America? The information age. We've gone through everything else. You can look at any country in the world, snapshot it, and find out where they are in their evolution by where they are in their economic development. So we're living in an economic era. The 21st century is an economic era. It is defined by economics. And now let me move to the social components. So I covered history. I have touched on business, but not just enough. Let me go and speak to the Federal Reserve now. According to the Federal Reserve, 80% of the economic activity in the United States of America is on the back of the U.S. consumer. I'll repeat that. 80% of the economic activity in this country is on the back of you and me. We stop buying Starbucks coffee. We stop going to conferences, stop traveling, stop paying lease payments, stop buying refrigerators. The economy comes to a grinding halt. Witness post 9/11 for 90 days. Nobody bought anything anywhere. And the economy is still trying to recover. 3,000 miles from New York after 9/11, in California, we lost 50,000 jobs tied to 9/11. How do you lose 50,000 jobs tied to something 3,000 miles away? Tourism, hotels, transportation. It all stopped. What am I suggesting here? This is not a goody two-shoes issue. Why is Chairman of the Federal Reserve Alan Greenspan, who has no political ambitions and doesn't do anything unless it's substantive, unless he's sending messages, why does he go into a classroom with somebody as crazy as me? Why do that? Why did 10 of the Federal Reserve presidents join me in classrooms after Chairman Greenspan? It could have been a fluke. He could have just done that and said, nice to do, let's move on. Why did 10 of the 12 Federal Reserve presidents follow me in the classroom? You will soon have 11, I hope. I think they're sending him. Why did Chairman of the FDIC, Chairman Powell, go into a classroom with me 4 times? Why is he's the honorary chairman banking on our future across America? Let's now turn to public policy. Why is the White House talking to me about Social Security reform? You don't see the tie-in? Oh, yeah. Let me help you. How do you manage your own Social Security account? You can't manage your own checking account. We're talking about personal responsibility here. What's a health management account if not a wealth account? What is an ownership society? You can put me into a home, but you can't keep me into a home unless I'm financially literate. How do we convert a check cashing customer into a banking customer, a renter into a homeowner, a small business dreamer into a small business owner, a minimum wage worker into a living wage worker with new job skills, the economically uneducated to the economically empowered? How do you move people up and out of poverty in an information age where education is king? The ultimate poverty eradication tool in 2005 is education. How do you do that if you don't know better, you can't do better? There's an old Southern saying, no matter how much I love you, my son or my daughter, if I don't have wisdom, I can only give you my own ignorance. And so out of love, we pass down bad habits from generation to generation. It's what we don't know that we don't know that's killing us. Social movement. In 1968, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. He also, before he was assassinated, started the Poor People's Campaign. I don't know if you remember that movement. Didn't get much press. Do your research. Poor whites. There's more poor whites in America than poor anybody else. Poor blacks, poor Latinos, poor Asians. Yes, there are poor Asians. Poor everybody. Moving them up the economic ladder because he realized, and I quote, you cannot legislate goodness and you cannot pass a law to force someone to respect you. The only way to social justice in a capitalist country is through economic parity. Ownership. It was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. Let's fast forward to 2005. Ladies and gentlemen, what I just described for you, what I tried to describe for you in 18 minutes or so, is a paradigm shift. All the arrows coming together. Why did Ambassador Andrew Young, the right-armed Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., arguably the living legacy of civil rights, why has he joined our movement as our national spokesman? Because he said, and I quote, Martin and I, he can say Martin, I can't, to me he's Dr. King. Martin and I succeeded in integrating the lunch counter, the public building, and even the schoolhouse, but we never integrated the dollar. He said, capitalism in a capitalist society with no access to capital is nothing more than a sophisticated form of slavery. And he has said, Dr. King would be proud to know you're continuing the march to end poverty. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not here to talk about a program. I'm not here to talk about Operation Hope. Because if you can do it better here without me, I would be the first to say, bravo. I'm talking about sparking a movement. Because that's what's necessary. Ambassador Young understands that America is in a moment in history. The ownership society that President Bush suggests, forget the fact of the political parties, and that's irrelevant. An ownership society, if it moves forward, will either help to create more parity by creating more ownership, or it'll create more separation by creating more of a dumbbell economy of the very, very rich and the very, very poor. You know what the difference maker will be? Financial literacy. If I don't know better, I can't do better. Somebody might say, well, predatory lending. We just need a law against predatory lending. Well, you probably do need a law, but you cannot pass a law to protect me from myself. You know, in 1992 in South Central LA, there were more liquor stores in South Central LA than 13 states combined. And guess what was next to the liquor store? The payday lender. What was next to the payday lender? The check casher. Why? Because there's a difference between being broke and being poor. Being broke is an economic condition. Being poor is a disabling frame of mind and a depressed condition of our spirit, and we must vow never, ever, ever to be poor again. If I don't like me, I'm not going to like you. If I don't feel good about me, I'm not going to feel good about you. If I don't respect me, I'm not going to respect you. And here's a big one. If I don't have a purpose in my life, I'm going to make your life a living hell. Ladies and gentlemen, we're all tied together. The gated community is a confirmation that we've failed as a society to solve some social problems. You can't wall yourself off from problems. You can't get away from problems. They're all around you. So it is in our enlightened self-interest on the bottom end to turn the tax dependent to a taxpayer. On the top end, all boats can rise if we create stakeholders and homeowners, because the best police you can have is a homeowner, and the best family value you can have is a job. Are you with me? So what am I here to talk about today? How does all this relate to you? On April 12th, Ambassador Andrew Young and I will meet in Atlanta. You're all welcome. And we will launch a forum entitled From Civil Rights to Silver Rights, the dawning of a new movement in America. And we will gather together the civil rights leaders, and they will pass the torch to a new generation. By the way, it is not civil rights leaders. It's the three-legged stools of hope: government, community, and the private sector. This is what's going to be the coalition, embodied of all races, that will be necessary to impart and to spark this movement. I'm not talking about a socialist thing. I'm not talking about a giveaway program, because folks in these communities don't want a handout, they want a hand up. Do you know that we funded $130 million in loans, created 1,000 low-wealth homeowners in 11 years, and not one home loan has gone bad in 11 years? These are market rate loans. These are not subsidized loans. These are regular Bank of America, you know, Bank of Hawaii. These are regular loans. But we made a concentrated effort on the front end to give people massive financial literacy injections. When you walk through the front door of a Hope Center, it says, no loans denied. So we approve you day one. The Hope Center is across between a bank branch and a Kinko's for empowerment. One-stop shopping for changing your life. We have just built one in that third world country called Anacostia, right outside of Washington, D.C. The third world country with no sidewalks is 4 minutes from the White House. Hopefully President Bush will come and cut the ribbon within 2 or 3 months' time. And so when you walk into a Hope Center, it says no loans denied. Gives you your hope back. Then we approve you day one, subject to the resolution of your primary denial factors. With your authorization, we pull your credit report. Ooh, baby. Looks like a bus accident. Okay. But that's okay. A saint is a sinner that got up. We're going to give you credit counseling and case management and financial planning and dollar-for-dollar matching grants. Every dollar you put in the new savings account will grant you a dollar up to $5,000. As long as you buy a home in a low-wealth area, the money's yours. 1,000 homeowners. Not one has gone bad. We work with folks from 24 days to 24 months to resolve their primary denial factors. And on the back end, when they graduate, their FICO scores have improved an average of 100 points. You know how difficult it is to improve your FICO score? 100 points? Walking the front door, no bank wants to fund them. Walking out the back door, they got a thick file underwriting, copies of utility bills, copies of rent statements, copies of home bills, alternative documentation to prove you are credit worthy, a down payment that you didn't have before because we matched you dollar for dollar, resolution of your primary denial factors, a FICO score of now 675, and now you're low-hanging fruit. Every bank in town wants to fund your loan. No magic, just work. So financial literacy also is the grease of the gears of a new economy. I'm talking about emerging markets. I'm not talking about black people, brown people, poor people. I'm talking about the new market for the future. How did I start? I mean, in where I started. I talked about the business as a diversity, a diversity of business, and business as a diverse issue. I could talk more about it. I won't. If you're interested, you can go on the website, and I go as far back to the Civil War and talk about how that was not about slavery are not about me. It was about business and diversity. The diverse markets, the northern markets in the U.S. ultimately won out over the stagnant markets in the south. Working on an old market of the agricultural age and free labor. Free labor. Okay, there's coffee outside. You'll get that later. And so diversity has always been a business issue. And so what I'm suggesting today is that we have an opportunity to do well and do good. That these ethnically diverse communities are America's emerging markets of the future. Here in Hawaii, as we already mentioned, you have a majority of no one. You have a minority of everyone. A third of everybody is of mixed race. Guess who are the most financially illiterate? Those with language issues, those with cultural issues. But here's an across-the-board statement. A quarter of all Hawaiian youth do not understand what the stock market is. So says a report issued by the people of Hawaii. According to your statistics, Hawaiian youth are worse off in 04 than they were in 03. In 03, there was a 59% literacy rate. In 04, there was a 55% literacy rate. Now, we talked about 1.2 million population. That population is going to continue to grow. We live in an economic era. Now, many of them are going to be going to the mainland to find work. If you are not financially literate, it's not necessarily making more money, but making better decisions with the money you make. And so here's what we can do if you want to do something. We're the only national urban delivery platform for financial literacy in the country. I run this like a business. It's a nonprofit, but I run it with a bottom line expectation of providing results. We've educated 143,000 children, 35 kids at a time, in checking, savings, credit, investment, the history of banking and financial services. We have 250 financial partners, credit unions, banks, insurance companies, financial service firms, you name the firm, if it's a large one, they're a member. Citigroup, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, ING, Deutsche Bank. I mean, I can go on forever with the diversity of Alliant Federal Credit Union, Westcom Credit Union, the NCUA agreement, the FDIC agreement, the Federal Reserve agreement, the Treasury agreement. We're working with President Bush on Social Security reform and the Ownership Society to make sure that financial literacy is a part of that so people can make sure that they see themselves in that policy and we don't have something that helps the rich and punishes the poor. The president is listening. I just met with him 2 weeks ago with 20 black leaders. You might have heard about that meeting in the news. And it was a two-hour meeting scheduled for 1 hour, but the president was so interested, it went for another hour. Ladies and gentlemen, we have an opportunity to make a change. $130 million in funded loans, as I told you, no delinquencies. 250 partners, 12 states, 15 cities, the District of Columbia, all from a dream of a young man with a $61,000 budget, one employee, and a vision to change the world and eradicate poverty, who started America's first nonprofit social investment bank. And people said, nonprofit social investment bank? That's an oxymoron, and John, you're a moron. They said it would never work. They dismissed me. It's a wonderful thing to be dismissed. Today I raised, just last year, $10 million for this stupid little silly idea. 80% of which is from the private sector, who have a bottom line mentality. We want to do well, but do good. And so we have 100 CEOs now on 7 of our boards. And now the question is, can we speak to the needs here in Hawaii? Here's my 5-year goal. We will educate not 1 million, 5 million children in financial literacy. And when I say educate a child, I don't mean, you know, checking one time, savings one time. No, when I say we've educated 143,000 children, I mean that every child went through all 4 modules, finished it, was competent, and can open a savings account and be trusted to move their lives forward. We've done almost 1 million sessions, or 800,000 sessions, 143,000 children have completed all 4 modules. So I want to educate 1 million children face-to-face in urban classrooms, teaching children checking, savings, credit, and investment, the history of banking. I want to recruit 25,000 Hope Corps members, volunteers from credit unions. This is your legacy. I mean, this is not what credit unions do. You don't do anything. This is all about community. This is about bankers and financial service people and investors being able to use their natural skills to help a child and be a role model too. I went into a school. Am I boring anybody? We're okay? I tell you, low self-esteem. I need some feedback. We're okay? I'm going to give you 3 more minutes and then I'm done and I'll take some questions if it's okay. I went to a school in New York, supposedly the worst school in New York. And I was told, John, don't have any high expectations. That's the first problem. The children lived up to what you didn't expect from them. Evander High School. Went into a gymnasium because they didn't have a proper place for me to speak. And the teacher said code 48 for be quiet. And code 49 for sit down. Because that's supposedly what works. I went in and I leaned against the wall in my suit and my tie, dressed very different from anybody in the room. And I waited for a minute and a half. It went from noisy to quiet to nervously noisy again. I just stayed quiet and to quiet. And when you could hear a pin drop, I said, you don't need code 46. You don't need code 48. What you need is hope. And somehow you knew without me saying a word that this was serious and you needed to stop what you were doing and to pay attention. If anybody interrupts me for the next hour, I will leave. For the next hour, you can hear a pin drop. But at the end of my presentation, a young girl decided to cut up. And so I ended my remarks and I left. The next day, I got an email from my staffer, Mary Haggerty, who said, John, you won't believe it. 2 children at the worst high school in New York City, where the matriculation rate was, I think, 1,200 kids went through the school and 200 kids graduated. You hear me? The next day, they tell me 2 of those young men showed up with suits and ties on. A young girl showed up and went to the career lab and said, I will go to college. Show me how. The next Monday, I got a letter from the little girl who cut up saying, you know, I don't get love at home. Nobody has ever told me they believe in me, and certainly nobody has ever told me they love me. So I didn't understand when a stranger came in my school and told me that I was loved and I was valued and I could do anything I wanted to do. And I did not know how to respond to you. I'm sorry, she said. She said, I want to be an eagle. Because we're talking about eagles and buzzards and turkeys. What kind of bird do you want to be? And I said, eagles don't fly in packs. You've never seen a flock of eagles. What kind of bird do you want to be? She said, I want to be an eagle. She said, John, will you let me write to you? Will you let me keep up to date on what I'm doing? And please believe in me, because now I believe in me. Ladies and gentlemen, I spent an hour with them. What difference can you make? We have 2,000 volunteers now. I want 25,000. We have educated 143,000 children. I want to educate 1 million on the ground, 4 million online. Those are suburban children, by the way, because inner city kids don't have T1 lines and internet access. I want to fund $1 billion in low wealth home ownership. We've already funded 130 million. I want 1,000 of America's leading companies to join our movement. We already have 250. I want to become a household name and the leading brand around financial literacy, economic education, and poverty eradication, because the 21st century demands an organization that will meet the needs of a new era. What do you think the Red Cross came from? What do you think the Urban League came from, or MALDEF? I mean, they didn't just kind of poof out of the sky and they were household names. They came from a little idea that somebody believed in and grew. We can do that. And finally, I want to spark a movement. If somebody else can do what we're doing, there's enough poverty to go around. But we have been at this for 13 years, and I'm dead serious about results, and I hold my people accountable for delivering on promises. So if we can partner with you, we can help you, we will bring our resources, we will bring our supporters to join you in your efforts to help your community. I will never come if not invited. Bank of Hawaii has invited me. Thank you, Kelly Walsh. The Federal Reserve has invited me. Thank you, Joy. But you haven't invited me. So I was here to just kind of have a conversation about the state of things. And if none of this resonates or speaks to you, let me leave you with this final point. You don't get any credit from God for being a pleasant person. from smiling. You know, it takes 8 muscles to smile and 35 muscles to frown. And there are experts at being miserable. Why are we frowning all the time? I don't understand it. You don't get any credit for being a pleasant person. You don't get any credit for raising your children or putting food on the table or putting a mortgage, paying a mortgage payment or putting a roof over your children's heads. You're supposed to do those things. You only get credit from God for helping other people. And I don't know about you, but I want a spiritual platinum car with no limit on it. Thank you very much for your time.